you see on so many occasions, and maybe you don't see them all the time, with the togetherness in the club, but also in the way that we prepared. Before we played against Lyon, we had pitches here that couldn't be used because of the snowfall. In minutes, the club managed to arrange that we could go to the Emirates and prepare for that game there. We could go to the Emirates, play some training minutes against Tottenham here last weekend, which was really important for us because we have new staff, new players that's never been to the Emirates before. All these things together, that's what build togetherness.
Hello and welcome to the Sound of Football podcast. I'm Graham Sibley and I'm joined by Terry DeFellin.
Hello.
Just us two again. Yeah, and still suffering from a bit of the lurgies, but there's a lot of it about, isn't there, Terry?
It really is. There's a lot of it about.
Yeah.
I'm not feeling 100% myself, if I'm being completely honest with you.
So go easy on him, listeners. When you hear his opinions, think, oh, yeah, he's not very well. So, so a little bit of sympathy there. But hey, I'm okay.
That's the main thing.
Because I had a very, very full weekend. I was going to come on and say, do you know what? I watched more live football this weekend than I watched on TV. But that would be an utter lie. I went to see two games this weekend, but I always watch a lot of football on the telly. And I ended up watching the North London Derby down a pub. And that's something that I really don't do a lot of these days, watch football down pubs.
Wow, yeah.
Especially something like that.
I rarely go to the pub to watch football. I mean, I went fairly recently to watch a World Cup game, but that's a rarity. It's the exception rather than the rule.
Yes.
I try to avoid going to pubs to watch football matches these days.
Yeah, with good reason as well. And I'm sure plenty of our listeners go, oh, no, that's a great way to enjoy a game. Have a few drinks, be with your mates. It's just a fun way of watching football. No, it's not. There's nothing fun about it at all. You can't hear anything. You can barely see anything. If you're in one of those pubs where they've got all the screens up, then you're drinking out of plastic glasses and you're just surrounded by arseholes. And the thing is as well, it's not like when you're in a football stadium and you're just, you know, quite regimented where the arseholes are sat around you. These ones, they're everywhere. They're coming at you from every angle. Anyway, there was a good result. Anyway, if it had been a bad result, it would have been a terrible night. But as it was okay.
It was a good result, I suppose.
It was. It was a good result. Yes. And we needed it as well because I'd actually gone to the Emirates at lunchtime. As I said on last week's podcast, I went to the Emirates to watch the Arsenal women play. And they were leading until very, very late on. And then Sam Kerr came along and snatched an equaliser.
Sam Kerr doing Sam Kerr things.
It very much was. As soon as the cross came in, you thought, yeah, she's going to get on the end of this. It seemed to take forever for that cross to come in and land on her head, but it did. It did. And it was right in front of us as well.
And how was your Emirates experience, albeit obviously a WSL Emirates experience?
It was wonderful. I had posh seats. We were in the middle row.
Ooh.
Which is, oh yeah, very, very swanky. Very, very nice. I mean, like going to the Emirates is pretty swanky anyway, but going on the posh bits, that was even swankier. So yeah, that was nice. There was 46,000 tickets sold. But I would say that most of those were there as well. There was a couple of seats behind us that weren't filled. But I think for most of the areas that we were sat in, you could see where they'd been selling the tickets from. They'd closed off one end, the clock end, the top tier. That was the only section of the ground that was actually closed off. There was no one in that. Everywhere else in the ground, there was people there. And there was only one real section on the west stand, top tier of the west stand again, that was a bit sparse. But other than that, it looked pretty full.
Wow.
Of course, you don't get too much of an atmosphere there. The best of time, the men's team can struggle to get an atmosphere going there. And with the demographic of a big, well-attended game in the women's game, it's so diverse that I think there isn't that natural build-up of atmosphere like you'd get if you've just got a big group of blokes together.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if one of them sat down, eating their crisps and their fizzy pop and just enjoying the action in front of them. And it's great, and you should all watch football however you want. You shouldn't be reliant on other people's joy and experience there to make the experience for yourself better. But it's just something that maybe going forward, they might think about maybe it's worthwhile for clubs if they can somehow harness some kind of, I'm not sure how I'm thinking, because I wouldn't want like a typical ultra scene in women's football, because I think that's just like imposing male ways of watching football onto the women's game. I don't think I'd like that. But I think if there was something that had organised atmosphere there, and it may seem a bit choreographed and a bit fake, but that's how singing started at football. Singing back in the 30s, communal singing it was called, and it was orchestrated. Just like the modern day ultra groups in Europe do it. It was an orchestrated event rather than something that was spontaneous. There'll probably be fans who go to a lot of women's games and think, no, we already get that. We already have that. The thing is, we have that in the small non-league grounds that we play in. And it's quite easy. I mean, look, we know ourselves from being at Whiteleaf. You only need a couple of hundred people. You only need about 20 or so to actually start singing, start chanting or things like that to get a decent atmosphere going, don't you?
Absolutely. But it's going to be more of an effort with the larger crowds.
Yeah.
I'm all on board with all of what you just said.
Yeah.
As long as people are happy to do it, as long as it's...
Yeah.
If it's desirable. I mean, when we went to the England-Spain game, in the first early stages of that game, it was... The atmosphere, well, I wouldn't say it was flat by any stretch of the imagination, but it was, it was just people enjoying themselves watching football. Once, obviously, the stakes started to get raised and it turned into a real contest, it was some of the best atmosphere that I've been to at a football match. And they had just some significant handicaps as well, because after all, it was hosted at a terrible stadium and yet somehow still managed to create an atmosphere because, it was being driven by what was going on in the pitch, and you can't always rely on that at football, because football can be notoriously dull when it wants to be. So it would be nice for the women's game to develop its supporter culture on its own without any supervision from anybody else. And if that's the way they want to go, I think, it would be quite nice to have a bit of a sing-along. Why don't we sort of like try and organise that? And I'm all for it. I'm absolutely all for it. And some kind of variation on some kind of ultra scene would work. But hopefully without any of the toxicity that comes with the men's game and the aspects of the men's game, that would be nice.
What was nice to see was Arsenal had appeared to have organised sections for Chelsea fans. So there were what looked like two distinct areas in the corners that were largely blue. When you looked across them, there was a blue tinge to them. That's something that has come up and caused quite a bit of discussion on social media. I know I've got into a few conversations myself about it. There are some people who watch a lot of women's football and they want designated areas. What happens when you have a discussion like this in social media, sometimes what people ask for can get misunderstood. So I think sometimes people have said, we'd like to have segregation like the men's game has, where you've got an area of day and this is where the away fans go. You can then buy those tickets through your club rather than having to become a member of the opposition or signing up to every other club in the league if you're going to all the away games, because that's currently what happens at the moment.
Right.
As far as I'm concerned, I hear that and say, well, do you really want segregation or do you just want an area where more of you are going to be so you can feel like you can generate an away atmosphere, you don't feel intimidated or anything like that? Because for me, segregation is where football's failed. That's a sign of football's failure, not it's one thing that makes it great. It's been around with us for so long that I think people have lost that, and they think it's just something that makes it more competitive, to make it more them against us, because you've got, especially like when you've got stadiums that are split half and half, like in a cup final or something like that. And I was thinking about times when I go to other sports and there is no segregation. So when I go and watch cricket and I'm sat there with Australian fans, which, it is good, because what you do is you get talking to them and, like, you have a bit of bants, but it's all good nature, and then that's fine. Of course, you can't have good natured bants in football. It's entirely impossible, isn't it?
It depends how you characterise good natured, I suppose, isn't it? These big crowds that we're seeing at the WSL and grounds like the Emirates, but others as well, I think that we're at a point now where we can say, well, this is here to stay now. This is something for the longer term. And so the opportunity is to look at the way that we allocate seats and allocate tickets in that new context, and we don't have to look at what the men's game does. Because the men's game's segregation is based ultimately upon excessive tribalism, violence, hooliganism, unpleasantness, sort of like stemming from what the late 60s, early 70s and through into the 80s, and still exists today. But that's not women's football's story. And they shouldn't get hung up on that. That said, I agree with you. I think that the idea of groups, of one, I think the idea of being a fan of a club and then being able to buy a ticket for an away ground through the club is eminently practical and has to be encouraged. And therefore, it makes then sense to have an allocation of a block or blocks, depending on the expectation in stadium, to say, right, this is where the away fans are going to sit. But they don't have to sit there. They can, if they want to, buy tickets to sit everywhere else if they want to go through the process. But we're going to make it nice and straightforward for them to buy those tickets there. Then they also then to get to sit together. They can have a little bit of a sing-song if they want to. They can just enjoy being in each other's company if that's what they choose to do. And I'm certainly all for that. That sounds positively healthy. I'm waiting for someone to come along and ruin women's football.
Well, Sky have got all the coverage of it at the moment. So
yeah, it could be Sky. It could be Sky who end up ruining it. But actually, to be fair, I think Sky's coverage has been very good.
It has. It has.
The coverage has been sensible and respectful and very good.
One of the things that Ian Wright said in his mostly excellent coverage of the Euros, one of the soapbox he got on after one of the games was he said that it's time that the WSL became part of the Premier League.
That's
where it could be ruined.
Yeah. I have opinions about the club structure. I don't know whether or not it's really ideal. I think it would have been better for the women's game to have developed its own club structure and its own clubs rather than finding themselves latching on to existing clubs. But that ship has long since sailed. So there's no point in having that conversation anymore. I just want to place on the record. I think it would have been better if they'd done that. But it didn't. That's not how it worked out. And we are where we are, and it's all good.
Yeah, that certainly is an academic discussion there in itself, isn't it? About the rights and wherefores of putting the club constructs from decades and decades of male-dominated football on to women's football, just to make it more palatable.
When the WSL was founded, my nearest club, I was living in Croydon at the time, my nearest WSL club was Chelsea, who played at the time in Tooting, which is not very far. There's no way on this planet I was ever going to go and watch a Chelsea game. and be any kind of fan. I mean, I was never going to get behind my local WSL club because they were Chelsea. The benefits, no doubt, massively outweigh, you know, the drawbacks. But there are drawbacks to that model. There's no way, as a guy who now lives on the South Coast, that I would support, Brighton playing Crawley, so it's miles away anyway. But were they to relocate to the Annex, there's still no way I'd go and see them because I couldn't bring myself to do it. You know, fortunately, Shoreham FC have a women's team and they're very good. So I do try and get along to theirs as much as I possibly can. So it's still all good.
Brighton may have to start playing at the Annex soon because God knows what's going to happen to Crawley. Maybe Brighton will end up buying their ground.
That is something that could certainly happen. Yeah. I mean, they're getting everything else right, Brighton, aren't they? So, I mean, maybe that's the next step for them. But I think that there's an appetite to see Brighton come and play in Brighton or in surrounding areas. You know, Falmer, obviously, because they don't play in Brighton, as is well established.
One thing that has to be said about women's football at the moment in England is that it's moving at such a pace that no one can really tell what position we're going to be in next season, let alone two or three seasons down the line. Made the little comment there about Brighton buying Crawley's ground, but that's really just what Chelsea did when they bought Kingstonian. They bought the ground and basically given it to their women's team, and now that's their dedicated home ground. But the capacity is less than 5,000, but it's less than 2,500 actually seated, which probably seemed like a perfectly acceptable number when they bought it back in, they started playing there in 2017, so it's 5 years ago now. But now you see Arsenal, three WSL games they've played at the Emirates, three games that have had over 40,000 people there. Now timing is everything because they've also played three Champions League games there and they've got somewhere in the region of about 6,000 or 7,000 for each one of those. And given the demograph of the fans that were going yesterday, hell of a lot of kids with one or two parents, So not entirely best suited for a 7:45 kickoff in the Champions League midweek. Certainly not going to happen. So at the moment, when you were thinking, right, okay, Sunday, midday, that's perfect. Perfect family time, isn't it? And so, yeah, you can get those 40,000 in there. Arsenal have said that they are planning to have all of the Arsenal women game at the Emirates. I'm sure that's going to be a nightmare to try to organise, given the fact that men's fixtures can be moved around across a weekend to suit TV. BT's only got, I think, one slot, haven't they, on a weekend? So if they suddenly put that into the BT slot, then all of a sudden that may shift what happens to a women's game. So you may end up having two games being rescheduled in one weekend. That just adds up to more problems down the line. And that's another thing as well, isn't it? Because if you've got rival TV companies who own the rights to it, of course they're not going to be well disposed to doing their opposition a favour. Sky never do. They'll always put up a game opposite a BT match, won't they, on Saturday?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is the thing that will play out. Politics of scheduling is going to be something, an issue going forward if they start getting numbers. And it's looking already like they are getting numbers. Because if they're getting 40,000 coming in, they must be getting numbers tuning in at home as well.
Yeah, so there's two things going on here. There's the marketing of individual games for ticket sales, which Arsenal in particular and other clubs do extremely well. So there's a big appetite as a spectator sport. I'd be surprised if that necessarily translates into viewing figures on the television. Historically, the viewing figures are still quite low. I know a lot of people watched the Euros because it was free to air and because obviously England did very well and also the home nations were involved in the Euros as well. But in terms of club football, the numbers are still quite low. One of the problems about the Women's World Cup TV coverage is that FIFA in their view, pitching the price for those rights at quite a high level. And so far, BBC, ITV have not met that. Now, that they want to and have been are committed to showing women's football, but bearing in mind the time zones that they're talking about, they're just not willing to spend that kind of money or any kind of money, to be perfectly honest with you. Now, if it was the Men's World Cup, it wouldn't be an argument. But it just goes to show that there's still quite a lot in terms of the broader British public that women's game hasn't really been sold to them that much. So we may be existing in a bit of a bubble there. And it's just something to just be mindful of when we're thinking about that.
As well, we still need that post-Euro bubble to settle down a bit before we can really start to see how much interest is it worth moving all the teams into bigger stadiums. Or is it just the Arsenal effect we're seeing here? Is it reasonable to say that they're getting 40,000 because they're Arsenal and they've just got a huge amount of fans? And of course, they've got some of the leading lionesses there. They've got Beth Mead and they've got Leah Williamson, who probably have the biggest profile in, well, women's sport, I should think, at the moment in England.
Yeah, I think attendances are probably quite lumpy across the WSL.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're right. They've got the high-profile players. But also, Arsenal are just like a hugely supported football club, particularly in the Southeast region. There's tons of Arsenal fans. I mean, all over the world and all across the UK. But particularly in there. And it's very difficult to get into the Emirates to watch a men's game, as you know well, Graham. And so although I'm not suggesting for a moment that they are settling for a women's game, but the idea of being able to go watch the Arsenal at the Emirates for a reasonable amount of money and be able to buy tickets is going to be very strong and probably quite easy to market for the club to do. Not all clubs are necessarily going to have that benefit. And perhaps, dare I say, not all clubs will market it as cleverly and smartly in the same way. It's also bound up with the fact that, there's more money down here in the Southeast, even now in these difficult times. There's a bit more disposable income. It's easier to sell those tickets than it might be, say, up in the Northwest, for example, or in other parts of the UK. So it might be a bit of an Arsenal effect that they've just got it going on. And, of course, there's just a general feel-good factor around Arsenal in general, isn't there? Because the men's team are playing okay too.
Well, you mean the favourites for the title?
Officially, yeah.
Official favourites for the title, Arsenal, having beaten Tottenham 2-0 in a pub that was full of Arsenal fans yesterday. I watched that. It was absolutely chock full of Arsenal fans. And I know Arsenal were the away team, so but it does show how many Arsenal fans there are out there, because this was London and the number of Tottenham fans were probably about two or three there. Now, this is a bit weird for me. It's been a while, but I can still remember it. I can still remember how it were when we were in the box seat for a title challenge. And it looks like it could be Arsenal and United going in for a race. It's very retro, isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely got that kind of Wenger versus Ferguson vibe to it, hasn't it? Apart from there isn't the obvious animosity between those two coaches, but yeah, it's old school, isn't it? And it's I guess it's kind of nice, I guess.
If you find that like enjoying Arsenal success like leaves a nasty taste in your mouth, you can always look at Serie A, because you've got an unlikely winner there as well, haven't you? Well, I say unlikely winner, but as we had Kirsten on the Christmas podcast, they've always been there or thereabouts, haven't they? And just not got it together just to win the title. And Napoli are doing so well in Italy now. And Arsenal are doing really well in England, and they are the favourites.
What's probably the most impressive is they had that injury setback with Jesus getting his injury. And I think a lot of people maybe looked at Jesus and thought, well, he seems to be the difference maker. But what's been happening is that Arteta has patiently assembled a squad. They've had their setbacks while he's in the time that he's been there. But he has been given time to be able to do that. And he made a couple of important signings, I think, in the summertime, Jesus being one of them. And it's just rounded things off, and they've been going fantastic. The thing about Arsenal is although they're kind of outside, you know, perennially for the last, I'd say, 10 years or so, outsiders for the title, really, you know, they are a historically big club. And so, yeah, they're a bit like Napoli. They're kind of there or thereabouts. And then they had those great years under Wenger where they were genuinely, genuinely challenging. And so they're never that far away from any kind of title conversation. But it's still a surprise to see them suddenly doing what they are. And a lot of this is because they've been associated with chaos so long over the last 10 years or so. Certainly the last 5 or 6 years, they've been associated with chaos, haven't they?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that's because the social media has generated or given expression to Arsenal fan culture, which is very, very florid and chaotic in nature. And fun for the outsiders. I mean, obviously, Arsenal fan TV was the great emblem of that. But it is, generally speaking, watching Arsenal fans talking to each other on social media is hilarious. I mean, they're all absolutely bonkers. And that lends itself to this idea that here is a club that just couldn't get its act together sufficiently to put on a title run. But actually what's happened is they got in a competent coach, a very good coach, and patiently assembled a good side. And look at where they are now. They're totally winning football matches.
Totally winning football matches. And every time I say, oh, yeah, we're doing well now, but oh, we've got an awful month coming up. And I've been saying that all the way through this season, and it just hasn't really happened. It's that they've dropped points in 3 out of 18 games so far this season, which is phenomenal, considering that in the same period of time, City have dropped points in 6 games. And so have United.
Yeah, although United is weighted somewhat because they had that terrible start.
They had that terrible start. And now, as we call him, Eric, 10 wins in a row, is or he will be when they play Palace this week.
Oi. Well, you're right. Who am I
kidding? There is cause for a little flicker of excitement among Arsenal fans. No one's going to go overboard. Well, of course they are. Yes, they are. Of course they are. They're Arsenal fans. But you'll always find Arsenal fans, and this is the beauty of it. This is why social media does so well out of Arsenal fans, because there's so many of them. And it's the same with United fans. It's the same with Liverpool fans. If you want to find extremists there, you will find them, and you'll find them in numbers. That's always the thing about big clubs. The vast majority of big club fans are very, very ordinary people. I mean, far more ordinary than I am.
But you've also got the, quotes, ordinary Arsenal fans who are also sort of like looking askance at the florid Arsenal fans. And in their own way, they're just as expressive and chaotic and mad as anybody else is. It's sort of like, oh, God, Arsenal Twitter. What are they like, eh? Yeah, you're not fooling anyone. It's all good content, isn't it?
Gary Neville reckons that Arsenal are going to finish third. That's his expert opinion. which I'm sure is just to like tap in for clicks from Arsenal fans. I think it's purely for engagement, that one.
I'm not certain that's an authentic opinion, to be honest with you. I mean, I don't know. I would never want to, you know, sort of like question the integrity of Gary Neville, but it is only football and there's nothing wrong with having sort of being playing fast and loose with your opinion. You know, no harm is being done here, but I'm not entirely convinced. I wouldn't be surprised if that's not actually what he thought. I think he's trying a bit of mind games.
Well, Arsenal do play United next week, I think it is. United come down to the Emirates next weekend. So it wouldn't surprise me if he's just getting that in there quickly because, yeah, United too are in the race. They're only a point behind City. Newcastle are there. They've played a game more. They're only a point behind City. So there are plenty of teams chasing Arsenal if they do slip up, if they go for a couple of games and drop points, lose a couple of games in a row, if they lose a couple of key players as well. Their squad isn't that big at the moment, but they've got 10 points in their four games since they've come back from the Christmas break against decent opposition as well. All right, West Ham was in there, but other than that, there was a win against Brighton, a draw against Newcastle, which looks like de rigueur at the moment. Everyone wants a draw against Newcastle. Even Fulham should have drawn against Newcastle this weekend, but thanks to Mitrovic fluffing up his penalty, then that didn't happen. And of course, Tottenham, not just beating them, Tottenham, but humbling them at their own place, which never, ever happens anymore. Mm. No one wins away games in the North London Derby anymore. Arsenal have done it once, I think, in the last 18 years, I think. So it's certainly a big deal when it happens. And it's those sort of results like yesterday, that's the sort of thing that makes you think, actually, we could be onto something here. This could be the real thing. This isn't just like a false dawn here. And the expectation of Arsenal to crumble is perhaps playing in their hands a bit more because I don't think there is a lot of feeling from the media, at least. And I think for a vast majority of the fans as well, to think that this is actually going to happen. But they're playing the best football that I think I've ever seen Arsenal play, which is weird because I've seen some really, really, really good teams.
Mm.
Teams that have gone whole seasons unbeaten. But to get 47 points after 18 games. Now, Liverpool had 48 points after 18 games back in 2018. And they ended up losing the title by a point to City.
Yeah, but that's because City were just like super amazing, were even better.
Yeah.
I think Arsenal have the benefit of a City team that is not as ruthlessly good as previous City teams have. I think that on other years, and there's two occasions where Liverpool could have reasonably have expected to have won the title, were it not for the fact that City were just that little bit better. And again, this is not to suggest that Arsenal are being in any way fortunate because, you know, that's the way things are. That's how football works. City not quite up to it as we thought that they might be. I think when Haaland arrived, I think there was perhaps an expectation that they would just trammel through the league. And that actually hasn't happened. Maybe we've got more to learn. And they're not far away, and there's plenty of time. But I think that that's helped Arsenal a little bit. But there's no question that they're playing some amazing football. And yeah, the Tottenham result, I think, and performance, I think, probably as importantly. You know, that game was won essentially in the first half. And then it was, generally speaking, they kept the game under control in the second half. I mean, Tottenham did have their moments and they were a lot more aggressive in attack and tried to get back in the game as you would expect them to do. But generally speaking, I think that Arsenal handled themselves very well, albeit by the fact that they were helped with a big slice of luck for their opening goal, it should be said. I think it's probably fair to say that they earned that luck. But nevertheless, they were very lucky for that first goal because obviously you'd expect a Premier League standard goalkeeper to do a little better. Maybe conceivably with both goals, but certainly the first one. The Tottenham fans might be sitting here thinking, well, hang on a minute, they were lucky. Hugo Lloris had done things differently. Another goalkeeper, it wouldn't have happened. And they're probably right. But at the same time, I think at the centre, Arsenal deserve that two-goal lead. I don't think too many people would argue against that. Yeah. I'm sure there are some people who will.
Well, I'm sure all the Tottenham fans... Well, Andy will be able to tell us what they really think. But
Andy knows better than to take a few of our opinions.
Yes, he does. Completely beknownst to us.
Indeed.
Yeah, while Arsenal may be favourites with the bookmakers and probably have got the best chance of taking the title, there are going to be plenty of twists and turns in this race this year. And I think because there are so many teams chasing them down, with three teams really likely, after you get past them, then it's like, yeah, it's a real shower.
Yeah, but that's the Premier League, though, isn't it? Yeah. Though? I mean, the Premier League's benefit, the Premier League, is it's usually got four or five very, very good sides.
Yeah.
And then the rest of it is pretty average. Whereas in most other senior leagues, it's perhaps one or two or two or three good sides, you know, and the rest of it's pretty. That whole idea of, oh, anyone could beat anyone in the Premier League, it's kind of nonsense. But it's just that there are slightly more genuinely good sides in the Premier League, just to keep things going. I mean, you say, oh, it could be more twists and turns. I mean, fair enough. I think that that's quite good copy if you're looking to sell Sky Sports subscriptions. But actually, I think it's also equally likely that Arsenal just carry on winning and are declared champions in mid-April. So I'd say that was quite lucky. But because I'm not a fan of Arsenal, I can say these things without putting any hex on the matter.
I've got the mockers button right here, shining red. Please allow me to put them onto Arsenal now. Now, I don't believe in the mockers. Of course not. How can my opinion on one podcast have any bearing on the way that the season goes?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I suppose how much you'd subscribe to the butterfly effect.
Ooh.
Chaos.
Chaos.
Life finds a way.
Oh, well, how much chaos are we going to be invited to watch this weekend, I wonder? Because, Terry, German football has finally returning. It's finally returning this weekend, isn't it?
Those lazy Germans are finally, they're dragging their heels back to work. Sitting down there, oh, yeah, how was your new year? Yeah, it was great. No, seems ages ago now, really. Well, that's because it was ages ago.
You can just imagine all the fans that are turning up to the ground saying, is it too late to say Happy New Year? Yeah, it's really too late to say Happy New Year.
Yeah, it really is. It's not too, yeah, Happy Easter more like. Yeah, Leipzig versus Bayern is the opening fixture of the new game. Bayern Munich, of course, without their goalkeeper, Manuel Neuer, who is injured in a skiing accident. We wish him well. I don't think he was supposed to be skiing. And so there's all kinds of talk about who his replacement is going to be. But that's actually, to be fair, that's pretty much the limit of narrative in Germany. It's all fairly uncontroversial. Dortmund are waiting on Youssoufa Moukoko as to whether or not he will sign his contract. And the latest on Bellingham from Patrick Berger, who's an extreme, not the ex-Liverpool and Czech Republic player, but the German football journalist, Patrick Berger. Jude Bellingham genuinely undecided about what he wants to do and has not declared his interest. Dortmund, despite me inferring that Dortmund would be happy to see him go, apparently they've offered him a massive pay rise and offered to make him a top earner. So they would like him to stay, which is interesting because that's not normal what you associate with Dortmund. You expect Dortmund to sell him on, but they're saying they want to keep him.
Well, they've got to do something because they can't be short of a bob or two after selling off a lot of really good players. They must be sloshing around a bit in the old coffers.
Well, if that was the case, then why are they holding out with Moukoko? I mean, like, he's clearly the real deal. He's due his proper for his contract, and they're holding out on that. Now, well, I don't know the other side, what the sides are in there. Dortmund, I think, live on a bit of a knife edge, because if they go in a prolonged period of time out of the Champions League, they could end up like Werder Bremen or Schalke or Hamburg and just like losing loads of money. They'll be like, their overheads are huge. They need that Champions League money, really. So they're on a bit more of a knife edge than a lot of clubs. And so I think they do need to be careful. But I think Bellingham, they clearly identify as, well, they're not the only club, as someone who can, if he could keep him for another 3 or 4 years, then I think it would be tremendous for Dortmund. And again, as we keep saying about Bellingham, he's only 19. You know, he could leave in 4 years' time. He'd be 23, still actually young, you know, still a technically young player. Sorry, that was a very, very lengthy and diverting preview, wasn't it? There's been nothing to talk about. So now it's back. I'm kind of excited and happy to talk about it. So we'll see what occurs there. But yeah, Leipzig v Bayern, of course, that will, of course, end up 2-0 to Bayern. But I'll preview it anyway.
It's going in the box set. Yeah, I didn't put Dortmund versus Augsburg in there, which I could have done. But that's because it's the same time as Arsenal-Man U on Sunday, which I'll be covering for the box set, I'm sure. Arsenal appearing in the box set might become quite a regular feature. But don't let that put you off, listeners. There are plenty of other good games in there as well. Jan will be getting off his sick bed to do the Sunderland Borough match on Sunday lunchtime.
Ooh, that's a tense local derby, that is.
That is, yeah, very tense.
Oh, no, yeah. Love lost between those. No love two. Lost.
In fact, it's probably, I think they're even closer than Sunderland and Newcastle. I think like it's like what side of the street you're on, I think. It's that, yeah, it's that type, that local, that rivalry. It's one of the most intense in football.
I'm certain I've heard Jan say that in many ways it's the bigger game than the Newcastle-Sunderland. I'm sure I've heard him say.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, he always does. He's always saying that. He's always saying, no, that's the one I always look out for in the calendar. Yeah. Yeah, so he'll explain that to you listeners in the box set that will be coming out there on Friday lunchtime. And if you want to read what we put down for all of these games, including Palace-Newcastle, you're going to win that one, aren't you? Aren't you? So, yeah.
No, we're never winning a football match ever again.
No, this is true. This is true.
Never.
Or Liverpool-Chelsea. That's going to be a fun game, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So if you do want to read what we think about the seven games that you should be watching from Friday to Sunday, then get along to sofpodcast.com, click on the link for the weekend box set and sign up. And it will be in your inbox, somewhere in your inbox. Maybe the spam folder, but it will be somewhere there. If you put the right email address in, that is. it will be there on Friday lunchtime. You've got to make sure these things, Terry. You can't just leave things to chance. Dude,
As someone who manages newsletters, I know exactly where you're coming from.
But that's all we have time for this week. So from me, Graham Sibley, and from Terry DeFellin, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.
You can contact us through our website, sofpodcast.com, via Twitter, @SoundOfFootball, or on facebook.com/SoundOfFootball.
I wouldn't put that in as the Easter egg if I was you.
No? Okay.